Welcome back to the show, everybody. This week, we are talking about Gordon Murray, one of the most legendary designers, both on and off the racetrack. You know his work. He's made the McLaren F1. He has a current car called the T50 with a big old fan on the back, sucking it to the ground. And he's also designed some really amazing race cars over his career. Without further ado, Gordon Murray. When two Parmalat-liveried Brabham BT46Bs rolled up the grid, at 1978's Formula One Swedish Grand Prix, the car's first race ever, it was already deeply hated among the rest of the field. When told to go easy and sandbag their driving in practice, teammates Niki Lauda and John Watson just couldn't help themselves and drew a bit too much attention to their blistering lap times. So much for being inconspicuous. Even after brimming their fuel tanks to slow the cars down, they easily achieved second and third position right behind Mario Andretti in his seemingly unbeatable Lotus 79. The cat was out of the bag, and when the checkered flag waved 70 laps later, Lauda was the first to see it, 34 seconds ahead of P2. One man, just 31 years old at the time, was the reason behind the clever engineering that made this car an instant legend. Afterwards, between 1981 and 1991, he played a major role in five F1 World Championships. This wasn't some silver spoon rich kid situation either. His beginnings were humble, and if it weren't for a chance visit to a major name in F1 in 1969, he might have never earned his reputation as one of the greatest automotive designers of the 20th century, both on and off the racetrack. This is the story of Gordon Murray. Where did he come from? What was his inspiration to dig into motorsports? What was he responsible for at both Brabham and McLaren in the 70s, 80s, and 90s? And what jaw-dropping hardware has he had his hand in since? All that and more this week on Past Gas, it's Gordon Murray. Welcome back to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. This is Past Gas. Across from me is Bart Bidlingmeyer. What's up, Bart?
Hey, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Happy as always.
How are you?
Doing well.
Good. Okay.
Did you go to the blowhole?
We did. And this is in Mexico.
Right.
It's not like behind a 7-Eleven.
Not a glory hole. It's a naturally occurring phenomenon.
La Bufadora and Ensenada. Yeah, it was really good, really fun times.
Did you go to that sketchy place where you can pet little baby leopards?
No. I don't. I hate that stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a few of them popping them up, like other places too.
Yeah.
It's like, where do you get these exotic animals? I don't trust this.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they try to be like, no, they're ethically sourced. And it's like, no, you're shooting a mama or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. And that other voice you hear, Joe Weber.
Just try to guess what kind of engineering my hands are in right now. What is it? What's the line?
Yeah, you got it. How are you, Joe?
I'm good.
How's the kid treating you, dude?
Really fun development this morning. I heard him pushing around. He's got like this little donkey that plays a song. Yeah. It's like a Fisher-Price thing, whatever. I heard him pushing it around while I was getting his breakfast this morning, and then it got a little quiet and I was like, oh, what's going on? And I turned the corner and he had pushed it to the dining room table.
Okay.
And he was standing on top of it.
Oh,
trying to get to a bunch of pens. Mm. And so that's the future there.
Kid wants to write.
Yeah.
What a little sneaker.
I know. But it's just his face is
the
like,
face,
you caught me.
I'm not doing that.
We were at an Airbnb. And I kind of heard like, you know, like when it's a little too quiet.
Yeah.
Like you can hear it anyways. Mm-hmm. I went to check on my kid and there, the Airbnb had like a liquor cabinet with a lock on it.
Oh,
he undid the lock. Whoa. It was a little like a 4-digit combo lock.
He figured out the combo.
Yeah. And I go, did you just, and he just goes, Oopsies. Yeah. But I was like, I'm more impressed than like.
But you can't be like, great job,
right,
because then he's
right.
gonna try to pick every lock. He's gonna be an anonymous someday.
All right. As I mentioned in the intro, we are talking Gordon Murray today.
Great intro too. Lots of questions. It reminds me of the teaser trailer for the Transformers the movie.
The Transformers, the movie.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it's called. Where it said, will Optimus Prime die? And if so, who will become the new leader of the Autobots? And you're like, why would you ask either of those questions?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So,
what are their qualifications?
Yeah. How long is the resume of the three top applicants for leader of the? Which is like, of course you're going to die. Why would you ask that question?
You're like 11 years old.
And then it's
like, huh?
Yeah. And then it's like, who will replace him? And it shows Ronimus Prime. And you're like, well, now I know the answer to both of those questions.
Ronimus Prime.
I think that's right.
Gordon Murray developed what would become a lifelong passion for motorsport very early on in life. Born to Scottish immigrants in Durban, South Africa in 1946.
Durban. Where I get my poison from. Durban.
Have you been to Durban?
I haven't been. No, yeah, I've been to Durban. Durban.
Gordon. Durban poison is a strain of weed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Got that base covered. That's good. Okay. Gordon has many fond memories of watching
motorsport. Put that at the timestamp at 420.
Mm. That'd be sick. Okay.
Sick, dude. Oh.
What is that?
That's the stone lap.
Oh, it is. There's also like when you're trying to hold the smoke in and you're like. Right?
Gordon Murray has many fond memories of watching motorsports as a child, as young as 5 years old. It helped that his parents were big fans themselves. In fact, his father raced motorcycles before World War II broke out. Quote, there wasn't a month that went by without us going to a racetrack to see motorcycles or cars or to a speedway. So I grew up in that atmosphere, he said in an interview a few years back on the David Cerrone Drive Experience YouTube channel. Once he became a teenager, Gordon started on his goal of becoming a race car driver. He hadn't yet considered race car design. He just wanted to be in the seat ripping laps. Though at 6'4", it was tough. After all, sports, formula, and prototype race cars are pretty tiny and were especially so back in the day when people didn't eat enough vegetables.
Okay. You know the meme of boomers not drinking any water?
Yeah. He drank his water.
What is it?
Boomers just don't drink water. My parents don't ever drink water. We like on our wedding day. Because it was
he
like
just did air quotes for did. Wedding day.
Because it was like the like courthouse kind of wedding okay, we did okay. in Tucson. That was like a quickie kind of thing. We drank four of us drank a bottle of whiskey that was like this big, and like around 3 o'clock, my mom's like slurring her words, and I was like, "Mom, you got to drink a glass of water." She's like, "Well, no, I don't." I'm like, "You got to drink a water." And so gave her this water. And then by the time we went to bed, she's like, "Where's my water?" She had drank like two sips out of it.
After high school, Gordon enrolled in Durban University of Technology with a focus on studying mechanical engineering.
I like to keep a glass of water next to my bed on the nightstand just in case I want to spill water all over the floor.
It's good in self-defense situations, yeah.
And you're always like, ah, damn it. On your clothes and your underwear.
He later secured an apprenticeship to gain experience and make a little bit of money. His family was of modest means, and he himself was a poor late teens, early 20s student. So the only way he could go racing was to design and build his own car. What he came up with was a Lotus 7 resembling sports car known as the T1 or Type 1. By the way, that's how Murray distinguishes his designs. It's always a T followed by a period and a number.
That's a pretty sick naming system, yeah. Honestly.
It's a good job he designed the T1 himself, as again, it probably would have been tough to fit his lanky frame in a small race car of the era. The T1 took 2 years to design and build, was lighter and stiffer than the real deal from Lotus, and featured a tiny Ford engine sitting right behind the front wheels. He raced the T1 in South Africa for 2 years, earning wins on local circuits and hill climbs.
It looks like a really fun race car.
But when 1969 rolled around, the young South African realized that if he wanted to truly pursue his passion as far as possible, he had to move to the capital of motorsports design and engineering at the time,
Antarctica,
the United Kingdom. Murray sold off all of his possessions, including the T1, bought a ticket to board a ship, and set off towards England. His ultimate goal was to work for Lotus, Ford, or any number of other manufacturers, and in any capacity that he could.
This is 69. Why wouldn't he just fly?
More expensive, probably.
Yeah.
International airfare at the time?
I don't know.
Kind of a luxury, I think.
Okay. What he did was he wrapped his body to look like a vase in a...
he stood really still container
because it was way cheaper to ship a vase.
They carry him on his side,
but he was so ticklish, so they're like, why is this vase giggling?
Going for Lotus made sense for Murray. Carefully crafted through a lifelong passion for motorsports, his studies, and a short tenure in motorsport design, the foundation of his beliefs is that simplicity and lightness are key in developing a fun to drive car and even a race winning car. It's the old Colin Chapman philosophy. Less mass to haul, less rotational mass to sap power, more communication and grip, the ability to balance weight across a chassis as effectively as possible, and so on. Under the direction of the legendary Colin Chapman, Lotus was at the forefront of all of this. After being in country for a few months, Murray caught wind of a job opening that would truly change his life. He was at an interview for a draftsman position, and it wasn't working out. The gentleman who'd brought him in was being a bit wishy-washy over whether he really had a shot at working there. One of the designers gave Murray the heads up that Brabham F1 was just up the road and looking for somebody. By this point, he'd become so financially strained that he didn't want to call a taxi, so he walked all the way to the Brabham HQ.
He once again disguised himself as a vase.
He walked all the way to Brabham HQ with no plan. Just pop in uninvited, see what's up. What could go wrong? Well, it worked. After conversing with technical director Ron Taranak, who didn't care much about his studies but was impressed by his background in building his own car and racing it, Murray was offered the job. Ironically, on his way out, he passed the guy who was actually scheduled to be interviewed that day.
That sucks. That man was Ron Dennis.
Oh.
No, I don't know. I'm just kidding.
Wouldn't that be something?
It's the only name I could pull.
Pretty good name. Pretty good one. Brabham was founded by Taranak and Jack Brabham in 1960, earning F1 World Championships in 1966 with Brabham behind the wheel, and 1967. When 1970 arrived, Jack Brabham had retired, selling his share to future FIA exec Bernie Ecclestone. Taranak wasn't keen on maintaining his share for much longer, so he sold his share to Ecclestone as well in 1972, giving the short, mop-haired Briton full control of the team. This would be Ecclestone's first time running an F1 team, even after being involved in the sport in some capacity for quite a few years.
And we've talked about Bernie so many times, and he's kind of a shifty character.
Very shifty.
And I couldn't put my finger on why I didn't trust him, and I think that describes it, because it's mop hair.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he hasn't changed his hair since he was a teenager in the 60s or
something.
He
does look like he's like a one of the original members of the Beatles or something still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he's the keyboardist that didn't make it
right
out of Hamburg.
Hamburg?
Yeah. They got their start in Hamburg. You guys don't know this story?
No. What? Hamburg, Germany?
Yeah. They played like 3 shows a night, 5 nights a week in Hamburg.
Oh.
And that's where they got their chops from, because they initially didn't have enough momentum in the UK. So they went and recorded and played a million shows in Hamburg.
Yeah. Sure. Didn't know that. Learn something new on this podcast every day. Gordon Murray had up to that point designed some Formula 2 and Formula 3 cars and brought a fresh perspective to Brabham that cleaned up their designs across the board. At one point, he was thinking about leaving, as his ultimate goal was to be a team's sole designer, particularly in prototype racing. He was made an offer by another operation, but right in the nick of time, Ecclestone fired the other designers and promoted Murray to lead designer for Brabham's F1 program. His first tailored design was the BT42 in 1974, followed by the BT44. The former was certainly an improvement over its predecessors, but the BT44 was the first car to start earning wins, 3 that very year.
Nolan, look at this car.
That's pretty cool looking.
That's badass. The front tires, the rear tires on this race car are like 3 times the size of the front ones.
Yeah.
And then there's this gnarly like vertical intake right above the driver's head.
Very cool. The nose too, the shape of that's pretty sick.
Yeah, it's really cool. Damn, that's so cool.
However, a real legend was on the horizon. The Cosworth DFV V8 was the de facto go-to power plant for much of the field in 1970s Formula 1. We've talked about it on the show before. We have a whole episode devoted to this engine. It's a legendary piece of machinery, but Murray and Brabham were looking for ways to truly get ahead, poke and prod for that unfair advantage in the rulebook that nobody had discovered yet. Enter Alfa Romeo. Alfa supplied Brabham with free 3-liter flat 12s that made around 520 horsepower at 12,000 RPM.
Jeez.
That was enough of a bump in power to outrun the DFV equipped competition, though it had some drawbacks. Because it had more cylinders, more coolant and oil was needed to keep running tip top, and this meant more weight for Murray to try and compensate for.
So it's a V12?
It's a flat 12. 3-liter flat 12. Additionally, this was the beginning of the era when Lotus introduced ground effects that revolutionized aerodynamics. 1978's Lotus 78 and later 79. Due to its innovative skirt design, the Lotuses channeled air over and around the car quite effectively, reducing air pressure underneath and therefore developing more downforce with no drag penalty. This made their cars incredibly hard to beat. Over at Brabham, Murray realized the Lotus's aerodynamic advantage, but couldn't replicate a similar effect due to the Alfa Romeo's engine design. Because, you know, I imagine since that engine's so long, you can't have that the upward sweep necessary to make that kind of Venturi effect in your ground effect design.
You went to the Durban Polytechnic Institute,
right? That's right, yeah. Instead, more drastic measures were needed, like sticking a fan off the back. Fan cars were nothing new. In fact, they were made famous by the Chaparral 2J in Can-Am racing nearly a decade earlier, which we also talked about on this show a few weeks ago. Additionally, the plan was to utilize this comical yet brilliant design to suck air out from underneath, creating negative pressure and therefore downforce.
You put a lot of emphasis on suck.
With modified skirting to create more of a vacuum under the car, they were onto something. This new fan-equipped car was the BT46B. The fan was dual-purpose, 55% as a cooling aid and 45% as an aerodynamic aid.
Kool-Aid? Oh, yeah. Ooh.
As long as cooling was the primary purpose, the F1 rulebook deemed it legal. Loophole achieved. Sporting an iconic Parmalat livery and with multiple world champion...
Parmalat.
Whatever, dude. It's milk, okay? I don't give a shit.
It's milk? Really?
Yeah.
It's cheese-flavored milk.
So, with that livery and with multiple world champion Niki Lauda at the helm, the rest of the field was annihilated its first time out at the 1978 Swedish Grand Prix. However, due to protests brought on by Lotus and other constructors, and Ecclestone not wanting to rock the boat too hard, sadly, that was the end of the fan car. It was a one and done.
It's kind of out of his character to not rock the boat, though, right?
Yeah, sure is, Joe.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
So as F1 moved into the 80s, the turbocharged era ramped up pretty dang hard. Brabham was right there in the thick of it, boosting factory BMW 4-cylinders to the moon, coming up with innovative intercooler designs, and at times qualifying with more than 1,000 horsepower on tap.
Out of a 4-cylinder?
Mm-hmm.
What the heck?
Before Murray's time, I think what they would do is like turn up the boost and you had one shot. Like the qualifying format was not like today where it's the three rounds. They would just have one lap and, you know, turn the boost up as high as you can and hope that the engine doesn't blow by the end of that first lap. And if you did blow the engine, you have another one, a race engine that you're going to throw in. That's probably making like 700, 800 horsepower, like way less horsepower, but like more reliable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there wasn't like a limitation on the amount of engines you could use in one season?
I don't think so, no.
And a 4-cylinder is like way less expensive than...
Yeah, but I mean, it's still like an F1 race motor, so they're still pouring tons of money into it. It's just like, they didn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Must be nice, not caring.
Before Murray's time at Brabham came to an end in 1986, he designed 20 different chassis that accumulated 50 wins by 1986 and helped team driver Nelson Piquet win the drivers' championships in 1981 and 1983. By the mid-1980s, Gordon Murray had made a name for himself as a top designer in F1, especially after Piquet's two wins inside of three seasons. He'd been at Brabham for over 15 years and was starting to feel a bit burnt out. He wanted a new and fresh challenge.
We don't know what that feels like, right?
No, definitely not. Murray was approached by McLaren in 1987 and offered the job of technical director. He took it as part of a 3-year contract, and when he arrived, he was shocked at how different an operation it was. Not in the sense of being a big shop with endless resources, but rather due to being so disorganized. Brabham was a much smaller team that ran on a substantially smaller budget, but they had a strict engineering regimen that McLaren did not, testing gearboxes, engines, cars, torsional studies, and more. Before any new design was done under Murray's watch, he implemented all of this to bring the motorsports giant up to speed.
Yeah, what are they doing?
Yeah, I'm surprised coming from if it McLaren wouldn't be organized like that.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
But you're wrong.
Bruce McLaren, you know, he was like a very scrappy guy.
Eccentric
New Zealand,
billionaire,
like,
doing it his own way.
Well, yeah, but he had start. He was much like Gordon Murray in that he started out building his own car from like, I think it was like from the 30s or something, doing hill climbs with that. I mean, he was like the same though, like from literally just self-made.
But
you know?
Didn't he die in like the 60s?
Yes. Testing the Can-Am car. Yeah. So it had been like, 15, 20 years at that point that he'd been dead. But still, so they're just using his name at this point, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
I haven't thought about it like that.
I wonder if they have to pay, like, for every McLaren sold, do they have to pay a royalty to his family or something?
I doubt it.
I doubt it.
They probably sold the rights.
Probably.
After he passed.
Yeah. So this change in protocols that Gordon Murray brought in quickly paid off. With Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost at the wheel of the McLaren MP44, the team won 15 of the 16 races in 1988. Its clean and simple Marlboro livery is one of the most iconic liveries ever. But underneath this sleek paintwork was Honda's turbocharged 1.5-liter RA16 V8, which received
It's
a V6, wasn't it?
Sorry, V6. I misread that.
It's one of the best sounding.
It's 1.6 liters is so small.
This V6 received as much as 36 PSI of boost and can push out 4-figure power numbers with ease. It was also the last turbocharged engine of the 80s to propel a team to both a World Constructor and World Driver Championship, bookending this wild high boost era of F1. As much as those 15 wins made 1988 one for the history books, the single loss at the Italian Grand Prix did too. While hanging out in the airport post-race and dealing with a lengthy flight delay, Murray and McLaren upper brass Mansoor Ogier got to chatting about going beyond the paddock and building a proper road car. Other top personnel were there as well, and all agreed that it'd be a great thing to dig into.
Dig into.
Murray had always wanted to do something for the street, and after 15 years of hard work in Formula One, he was well prepared to take the skills he'd finally honed in race car design and packaging, mix it with his lifelong passion for lightweight, communicative sports cars, and build something truly awesome. Little did anyone know how significant the product of this little discussion in the airport would be. Murray was in. McLaren Cars was now a thing, and the entire company puts faith in Gordon to design and build a road-going piece of high-performance machinery from the ground up. It would be a true driver's car, the ultimate driver's car. He did some extensive research to kick off his efforts. He went out to the canyons. He woke up at 7 a.m. and drove up to Stunt Road in Malibu.
7's not that early, Nolan.
7's when I wake up every morning. How about you, Bart? You're like a 5 a.m. guy, huh?
No. I was on Sunday because I was smoking a beef clod.
What the f***?
And it's the shoulder of...
Clod?
Yeah.
Smoking beef just clods over here.
Yeah. but like I thought I had set a 3-hour timer to get up and go.
Yeah.
And then I woke up and it was like 5 and you know, I had to go restart the fire and...
And how was that beef clod, dude?
It was good. I'm glad I did it. I wouldn't have done it. They're enormous.
Yeah, what the hell? I've never even heard of that cut before.
But I was at Smart and Final and it was like half off. So it was like $3 a pound.
Like, I'm wasting like, money if I don't buy this, I'm wasting money.
It said it was -$30. They paid me to take it.
It was gray though. So
yeah. No, it was good.
You know what I've been doing is I go to Target because they have really thin shredded beef for like Philly cheesesteaks. and I make bulgogi out of it.
That's good.
And it's always like half off for some reason. I don't know why. But you make the little bulgogi rice bowls. Bulgogi banh mi's are really good. Mm-hmm.
I love a good banh mi. Where you get your buns?
The bakery next door to my house. They're really good.
Through friends in the automotive industry, Gordon got his hands on a Ferrari F40, a Bugatti EB110, a Jaguar XJ220, and the Porsche 959.
This is like us reaching out and being like, hey, can we borrow your Lexus SC430?
It's just like that. It's just like that. He then tested each of them in dry and wet conditions on the road and on the track. And this wasn't some Goldilocks scenario looking for who did what just right and then copied them, but rather pick apart every car's faults.
Wow.
The EB110 was too heavy. It was overly complex and had horrendous turbo lag. The F40 had wonderful steering and was a lot of fun to drive, but the build quality didn't quite meet Murray's standards. The running joke about this Italian beast is that if you see clean welds on its chassis, it's probably been repaired.
Ha ha ha.
Got
How do you
him.
Laugh in Italian?
Ha 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 ha.
I don't know. There you go. The Jaguar was too dimensionally large and heavy like myself, and the 959, while a shining example of the era's top technology, wasn't different enough from a regular Carrera on the inside.
That's like the most point hairs, splitting hairs kind of thing.
Gordon wanted something truly bespoke, unlike anything else on the road. After ripping laps and twisty roads in all these cars, Murray wanted to create something that stayed true to his lifelong passion for lightweight, responsive, and engaging driving dynamics. After some back and forth about what McLaren was going to name the car, why not capitalize on the company's recent motorsport success? The McLaren F1 was born.
It's almost like fun.
The McLaren F1. The fun.
The fun. You're going to have a lot of fun driving this. It's fun, period, like that band.
Uh-huh. Murray didn't just create the car. He designed everything around it, too. The factory, the assembly line, the offices, the furniture, even. It was all up to him. And at the beginning, it was just Ron Dennis, head of McLaren at the time, Murray, and a secretary. Then they went to work hiring young, scrappy engineers to help see his vision through.
They went to work. They went to Home Depot and hired some young,
dun, 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 dun,
handsome guys hanging out in the parking lot.
The whole team was on a very strict budget of just £8 million, which even for that era was tight. Years
That's
later,
a heavy car.
Years later, in a podcast interview with Chris Harris, Murray recounted that he had no idea how he pulled it off with so little funding. But the McLaren F1 became an instant, true high-performance legend. It was chock full of firsts and proprietary technology. It was the first road car with a carbon fiber monocoque chassis. Aluminum, magnesium, and even gold are found throughout. It had a ferocious 6.1-liter naturally aspirated V12 from BMW, making just over 100 horsepower per liter, and it's bolted right behind the driver's seat. It was a masterclass in designing the perfect driver's car.
Designing,
sorry. I'm all f***ed up.
Oh, God, I'm so f***ed so up.
This is f***ed up. While it didn't...
The f***ing toad screwed me. The toad ripped me off.
Dude, go ahead, best part. While it didn't have a wing or other downforce-creating features, it did have a ground effects package that kept it sucked to the ground at high speed, and even integrated twin fans at the back, just like the BT46B that Murray designed years prior at Brabham. I didn't know that it had fans.
I also didn't know it had fans.
Well, that makes two of us.
Two fans. Two I am fans a fan of this fan. Car. Yeah.
Naturally, the McLaren F1 features three pedals and a 6-speed manual transmission.
Manuel.
And has a center driver position. That is not only one of the coolest design elements ever, but also ensures optimal weight balance across the chassis. Few expenses were spared in its production, and thanks to Murray's extensive background in race car packaging, it's quite intuitively laid out. I feel like I would get kind of over the center driver position thing pretty fast.
Like crawling over the seat to get into it?
Yeah.
You're not driving this car a lot, though. That's the thing.
I would be, dude. I'd park this thing on the street.
It'd all be worth it when you get double road head, though.
Ha 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 ha. You're right, dude. Yeah. Concerning the stereo, the only company that could meet Gordon's strict maximum weight requirement
was Hit Clips. They listen to 45 seconds of a song at a time.
That's so funny, dude. No, it was actually Kenwood, surprisingly.
There you go.
Deposits for this car started around 60,000 British pounds. And in spite of a worldwide financial recession in the early 90s, every single one of the 106 produced were sold. The 64 street legal versions went for around 640,000 pounds in early to mid 90s money, whereas 36 were dedicated for racing duty. The F1 was the fastest production car in the world for more than 10 years, reaching a top speed of 240 miles an hour and would remain the king of top speed till the Bugatti Veyron, which could hit 268. The F1 was designed first and foremost as a road car. It had comfortable damping, narrow body, and good visibility, and a race car second. In race-prepared GTR form, McLaren beat out every racing-specific prototype for first place in the 1995 24 Hours of Le Mans.
That's sick.
In fact, privateer-owned road car-based GTRs took first, third, fourth, fifth, and 13th places.
God dang.
Yeah. God dang.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Production of the F1 ended in 1998, and in addition to contracting with other manufacturers on projects, the next big project for Murray and McLaren Cars was in the works for the new millennium, a new high-tech piece of hardware from Mercedes. Dubbed the Mercedes McLaren SLR.
This thing's sick.
Yeah.
This thing was yet another fascinating exercise in using race-proven technologies in a road-going supercar. Mercedes came up with the general design. It was loosely based on its own SL Grand Tour. But McLaren did the aerodynamics, chassis engineering, and even built the manufacturing facility. Good lord. The shape of this car is kind of bizarre. The long hood is there for a reason, as every centimeter of its big supercharged 5.4-liter V8 sits behind the front wheels. Carbon fiber reinforced plastic comprises its bodywork, which presented a new challenge for Murray. How to do a car in this material in the numbers that Mercedes wanted. Remember, only 106 F1s were made over the course of a few years. Mercedes, though, wanted to build 500 cars per year. Murray came up with new, less labor-intensive, yet still quite innovative methods of forming the roof structure and panels, as well as other streamlined processes throughout to meet Benz's quota. The end result was a real monster. 617 horsepower, 575 foot-pounds of torque, finely tuned passive suspension. It had massive carbon ceramic brakes, fascinating aerodynamic elements, and all of this was in a big two-seat coupe. It hits 60 miles an hour in just over 3 seconds and reached 100 in as little as 7.5. While well-received by the media and enthusiasts alike, and reaching icon status by today's standards, Murray's harshest critic was himself. He did the best with the specs presented, but the SLR tipped the scales at over 3,800 pounds.
That's pretty heavy.
Pretty heavy. Big car.
These lightweight guys beat themselves up so much about weight. It's like, bro, you're doing your best work. Just chill.
By the time 2004 rolled around, Gordon had worked for all of his dream companies. He led Brabham's race car design. He was technical director at McLaren Racing during its golden era and created the utterly fascinating McLaren F1. Now, with all the experience and know-how in the world, it was time to build sports cars for his own high standards without any impediments. Founded in 2007, Gordon Murray Design kicked off doing design consulting for a myriad of firms. There are some fascinating studies here and there, with every one having a focus on lightweight and efficiency. The two truly go hand in hand, as one area of Murray's principles really came to life during this era. When low weight is priority, energy efficiency always follows suit. His smart car resembling T25 was a tiny little two-seater designed for city driving and ultimately was never fully realized in production. Fast forward to 2018, and his true masterpiece, the culmination of all his experience, was kicking off.
I'm sorry, this car sucks. This car, the T25 is just a...
Yeah. To say it's a smart car resembling is a gross...
Yeah.
It's a compliment to this car.
This is something Mini-Me would drive or Austin Powers.
Honestly, though, you go over to Europe, and if you saw this on the road, you'd be like, okay, they do things a little differently over here.
They do things a little differently over sense. Here.
Wow. What a, yeah, totally different. Like, it's not a supercar. It's a true city car.
Yeah.
Wow. Very interesting.
But it goes 280 miles an hour.
Our modern crop of supercars by McLaren, Ferrari, Lamborghini, and so on are nothing short of impressive. They're the fastest, most capable road cars ever produced, but they're still lacking in some ways.
Well, then that is a little short of impressive.
They rely heavily on comprehensive traction control systems. They're quite engaging, but not engaging enough. I mean, I guess if you're like the most jaded person in the world.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Like, that's what gets me about like auto journalism these days is like people like, you know, it's just like, it doesn't have the have quite the same character, does it? And you're like, it looks like something.
Nuts.
It's not. These yeah. cars are like 1,000 horsepower. They do 0-60 in 2.5 seconds. I get what they're saying because sometimes you do get to drive like older cars and they do have that charm to them because they're not fully hampered. And yeah. I get that's what they're really talking about. But at the same time, like, let's be happy like with what we got, man.
Yeah. Shit. I mean, what else would you talk about though if you didn't pick every little thing apart?
Well, I mean, again, I get what they're saying. And also, all these cars are built for like Uber billionaires who never drive them, so they need to be safe, right? Like, you can't have your cars killing your clientele. But at the same time, dude, like the Ferrari Daytona SP3 mm-hmm. that's out right now, it's like the sickest car ever, dude.
Yeah, but it's got no personality.
It's so cool.
Got so many electric nannies.
It's come got, on, nanny state.
You know what they? You brought up a good point. Like if car companies are killing their clients in cars that are too fast or unsafe, mm-hmm. they should be making clients and my proposition okay. is make a car that makes you so horny okay. that you want to have kids in it. And then the kids are like, oh, a Brabham. I was conceived in a Brabham. Now I want to get one.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting idea, Joe. Yeah. Okay.
Back to the double.
So yeah, these job. Cars have no personality. They suck. and while they possess curb weights that are generally considered light, they still aren't light enough, at least according to Gordon's design philosophy. Enter the T50.
This thing's cool.
Essentially, yeah. the McLaren F1, if Gordon Murray was completely unimpeded and armed with the most advanced technology available today. As Murray shared on the Collecting Cars podcast with Chris Harris in 2020, our current era of automotive technology is the best time to make it. 10 years too early and it wouldn't have been this good. 10 years too late and global emission standards might potentially prohibit it from being built. It's an interesting way of looking at it. These past couple of years have been the most prime window to make one final truly great analog driver's car, and the T50 is designed as exactly that. Upon first glance, it looks a lot like the F1. Murray's initial pen on paper sketch made it so. Out back, though, is a prominent fan doing his job that fans have always done on his creations, sucking. like the F1, it also has a center driving position. Under the rear deck is a naturally aspirated 3.9-liter Cosworth V12 that revs to 12,400 RPM, makes around 650 horsepower. No expense was spared in this thing's development. Its steering is only powered assisted at low speed for easy maneuverability. Otherwise, the hydraulic pump shuts off above 5 miles per hour. And what the driver is left with is glorious character-filled feedback. You know what? I would actually love this on my Civic. Something like that.
How do you do that?
I don't know, but I'd like to figure that out. That's cool.
We should interview Gordon Murray and see how to do it. Hey, Gordon Murray, I got a really lightweight race car that I need help with.
It's lightweight, naturally aspirated. Mm-hmm. Lacks features. So the car also has a similar overall size and footprint as a 718 Porsche Cayman, yet weighs just under 2,200 pounds. Wow. My Civic's lighter than that. The more recently unveiled T33 follows a similar formula, but in the form of a two-seat open-top roadster. Both of these cars command pretty astronomic price tags at a couple million bucks each, but doesn't really matter, as all planned examples have already been sold. So, great job, Gordon.
I really like this T33.
They are good-looking cars.
Yeah.
The Gordon.
The T50, T-series. It's like, bro, you just copied your own homework on the F1 a little bit.
Looks a little bit like a Pagani.
The T50,
but like kind of stubbier.
Yeah, I like the fan on the back, but this one, this T33 is very sick.
If you can't see it, the fan on the back is just a big Lasco box fan.
It's absolutely fascinating what Gordon Murray's done over the course of his career, especially coming from a modest upbringing in South Africa, and through some chance encounters, utilizing his deep passion for motorsports design and engineering to build some real juggernauts of the road and raceway. As far as what he's up to next, well, he's busy as always leading GMA with the production of the T50 and T33. They're building a Niki Lauda edition T50 called the T50S. It's a track-only variant that pays homage to both the late Austrian legend, but also the McLaren F1 GTR. This year at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, GMA is celebrating 60 years of Gordon Murray automotive design. At 78 years old, that's quite an achievement, and looks like he isn't slowing down anytime soon.
Good, because if he slowed down, I'd say, lose some weight, Gordon.
It's good stuff.
Gotta be light.
Because that's what he says about his cars.
Yeah, it slows down.
Not fat shaming him.
That's the story of Gordon Murray. This Niki Lauda one looks pretty sick, I will say.
Yeah.
And looks like the F1
GTR. Oh, God.
Oh, my goodness.
That's kind of like a McLaren papaya orange.
It is very papaya orange, isn't it?
Papayas, they look good. They don't taste that good, though. You like papaya?
I like papaya. It's been
a long time since I had papaya.
Kind of got some like funky, corpsey.
It does have a little bit of funk to it.
Use a little bit of lime, though. A little bit of lime and some yogurt. Yeah, maybe brown sugar.
All right.
That's a lot you have to add to it.
It's true.
Yeah. It's really not even about the fruit anymore, honestly. Thank you so much for listening. Follow Bart at BidsBardo. Follow Joe at Joji Weber. Follow me at Nolan Sykes. Big thank you to John behind the lens and the board.
Doing a lot of heavy lifting today, John. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. It's Past Gas, baby. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.